the rule has withstood all of the legal challenges that have been brought against it. It's time to move on.
A judge throws out Alaska's challenge to the roadless rule. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska First Lady Sandy Parnell speaks out against a cut to funding for investigating sex crimes.
The girls' identification and cell phones are taken. They are physically threatened and abused, and sadly, the girls have bonded with their captors.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A federal judge has dismissed Alaska's court challenge of the roadless rule for national forest land. Alaska had the last remaining legal case against the 2001 nationwide rule, which prohibits new road construction, reconstruction, or logging on large undeveloped areas of national forest land across the U.S. That includes parts of the Tongass and Chugach National Forests in Alaska. U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon ruled this month that the state missed a six-year deadline for mounting its legal challenge. Tom Waldo is an attorney with Earth Justice, a nationwide environmental law firm representing several environmental groups. Those groups joined the case to defend the roadless rule, and Waldo calls the latest decision a complete victory.
Not only is it too late for the state of Alaska to bring its case, but it's too late for anyone to challenge the roadless rule. The rule has withstood all of the legal challenges that have been brought against it, and it's too late for any more legal challenges. It's time to move on.
The rule impacts more than 58 million acres of forest land nationwide and was approved during the final days of the Clinton presidency. Democratic Governor Tony Knowles filed suit against application of the roadless rule in 2001. The Bush administration's Justice Department agreed to a settlement with Republican Governor Frank Murkowski and the state in 2003. What followed was an exemption for the road for the Tongass lasting from 2003 through 2011, when the roadless rule did not apply to the 17 million acre forest in southeast Alaska. A court threw out that Tongass exemption in 2011 and prompted the state's latest lawsuit. A timber industry group, the Alaska Forest Association, and other groups joined the state of Alaska in its 2011 case brought by the Parnell administration. Executive Director Owen Graham says it's frustrating the sides could not even argue the merits of the case.
It seemed really frustrating that, the state made a settlement agreement with the government, to drop their roadless lawsuit in order to get the exemption, and then the judge says, well, you should have filed your lawsuit, kept your lawsuit going. I don't know how we do that, how the state would have done that and got the exemption at the same time. It just seems like a catch-22, but, this was the judge's decision, so I'll let the state decide what they think the next step should be.
In an email, a spokesperson for Governor Sean Parnell wrote the state is very disappointed with the ruling and considering its options. Early Saturday morning, the U.S. Senate passed a budget, a first in 4 years. Joining us from the Capitol to recap the vote and how Alaska senators voted is APRN's Washington correspondent Peter Granitz. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Lori.
Peter, if it's been 4 years, how has the government continued to operate?
There have been what's known in Washington speak as continuing resolutions. Those are basically agreements that keep the government operating at previous year's levels worth of money. We're under that right now. In fact, the Congress, both houses of Congress, agreed to continue the continuing resolution through the end of the fiscal year, which ends September 30th. That's how it's been going for 4 years straight, but it looks like we're going to have a budget that will dictate to the Appropriations Committee how much money to spend for next year.
The vote happened early in the morning. Why was it so early?
Well, there were dozens of votes on amendments, and those are just the ones that got votes. I think there were somewhere in the hundreds of amendments filed. Most of those have zero implication on the budget itself. The vote on the final passage of the budget resolution was at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and that's precisely when people aren't watching. They were voting through the night. They started on Friday evening or Friday afternoon, and then they voted all the amendments through until they got to the final passage just before 5 a.m. It's important to note that a budget is a resolution. It's a statement of purpose. It doesn't have the authority of law. It gives these guidelines to the appropriations committees, which can in turn just ignore them and fund what they want to fund.
Why did so many lawmakers push to finally have a vote and have a budget?
Well, we've been hearing Republicans in the House say it's been some 1,400 days since the Senate passed a budget, and there was truth to that. The Senate hadn't passed a budget in 4 years. The Republicans had, or the House had passed its own budget all those years. That's where Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, the Republican from Wisconsin, he was the one, the face of the budget basically in the House. They always passed his budget, you know, mostly along party lines. Maybe they'd get a few Democrats here and there, but mostly Republicans supported that. But the Democrats in the Senate never did that. And one of the reasons is because these bills or these resolutions don't really have the legal authority to do anything. They're just statements of purpose. They show what the parties stand for. The Senate did, in fact, take up Paul Ryan's budget, the one that the House passed a couple of weeks ago. Lisa Murkowski voted for that Republican budget, the so-called Ryan budget plan. You know, that balances in 10 years with huge cuts to all sorts of spending, including the entitlement programs. You know, those are the big drivers of the debt in the country. It balances in 10 years. Every Republican, interestingly, voted against the Democratic budget in the Senate, and so did four vulnerable Democrats, including Alaska's own Mark Begich. He can now say he voted against his own party, and I can assure you in the campaign he will say he voted against his own party's budget. Remember, this is not like a household budget where you and I allocate money for the two-week pay period. These are just blueprints. These don't have dollar figures that say this gets that much and we have that much left over. These are just guidelines.
Peter, what type of amendments get included in these actions?
You will always have amendments that pertain to cutting foreign aid, abortion, really hot-button social issues that probably have nothing to do with government spending, or very, very little to do with government spending. Neither Senators Begich nor Murkowski had amendments that got votes, but we're talking about all sorts of amendments. There was one brought up by Robert Menendez, a Democratic senator from New Jersey, that would have looked at indexing the minimum wage. That's something that Senator Begich said voted yes for. Senator Murkowski voted against. It failed by one. There was an amendment to, you know, fund the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, the health care bill, Obamacare. Senator Begich voted against that. Senator Murkowski voted for it. It failed. If it passed, we would have heard a lot about that, but it didn't. Amendments in the budget resolution only need 50 votes to pass. The Keystone XL pipeline won a major vote of support. 62 senators voted in favor of expressing their support for the approval of the pipeline. And that's an amendment that both Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski could agree on. They both voted yes.
All right. Thanks, Peter, for explaining the budget vote for us.
Thank you.
That's APRN's Peter Granitz reporting from Washington, D.C. A move to reduce funding for a new sex trafficking investigation unit has one high-profile critic, Alaska First Lady Sandy Parnell. Parnell appeared in front of the Senate Finance Committee on Saturday to ask them to reconsider the state trooper budget. It was her first time testifying before legislators. Legislators stripped the $800,000 allocation from the governor's budget because the troopers did not investigate any trafficking crimes last year. The First Lady found that reasoning wanting.
The reason given for cutting the funding, however, is exactly why the funding is needed, because sex trafficking is a hidden crime that must be unearthed by investigators. Its victims do not self-report.
Parnell adds that right now, state troopers have limited experience in seeing the signs of sex trafficking. She says sex trafficking cases are especially difficult to recognize, and victims may not even realize what's happening to them.
The girls' identification and cell phones are taken. They are physically threatened and abused, and sadly, the girls have bonded with their captors.
Reducing sex trafficking has been a key issue for both the governor and first lady as part of the Choose Respect initiative. The Senate Finance Committee is currently reviewing the operating budget and is slated to consider changes to it this week. Money for the sex trafficking unit had been kept in the House version, and any differences between the two documents will have to be reconciled. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a basketball tournament that brings Southeast together.
It reminisces about old times, the old-timers do, and the younger ones watch and say, I'm going to be like them when I get older.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
The Sitka herring fishery went on two-hour notice today at 11 a.m. It means if Fish and Game calls an opening, the fleet has at least 2 hours to make it to the location of the fishery. But what prompts the two-hour notice? KCAW's Ed Ronco explains.
Before the fishery can open, state biologists like Dave Gordon look at samples of the fish, and they look at the eggs, or roe, to see how far along they are developmentally. A sample taken Sunday shows 8.3% mature roe, and two samples on Friday showed 7.2% and 5.6% mature roe. So, what does that mean?
Basically, it's by weight, the percentage of eggs versus the total weight of the fish.
Here's the quick version of how it works. A fishing boat takes a sample catch. They weigh all the fish.
And that includes males and females.
And then they start to extract the roe. Now, test sets usually come in tons. So let's say the sample is 100 tons. You extract the roe, or the eggs, from the herring, and you look at the ones that are developed. Those are called mature roe. And if you find, among that 100 tons, if you find 8 tons of mature roe,
then it's an 8% sample. Basically, for mature roe. Does that make sense?
The fishery goes on two-hour notice as the percentage of mature roe starts creeping up toward 10%.
You get below 10%, and just the cost of handling and processing versus the roe recovery is it just isn't profitable.
But it's tricky, too. The fish are valued for their roe still in the sack, which is sold as a food item in Japan. The higher the percentage of mature roe, the higher the price fishermen get for their catch. But if they wait too long,
and that's the game.
The fish spawn, they eject their eggs, and the commercial fishery is over. And that could be an expensive problem. Now, the next natural question is how expensive? Well, prices for herring aren't really known yet.
I understand the price is going to be good, so I expect it to be as good as last year.
And what was last year?
Knew you were going to ask that. And it's still kind of
Sitka herring, as it turns out, brought in about $640 a ton in 2012. That puts the value of the fishery last year at about $8.5 million ex vessel. Ex vessel means the price right off the boat. Of course, the Sitka herring fishery is about more than a calculation of mature roe or ex vessel value. It is the subject of documentaries. It is, to many, the sign that spring has begun. And it also has its critics. Subsistence gatherers of herring roe have argued in years past that the state's quotas are too high. This year's quota is just over 11,500 tons. It's the lowest since 2006. But last year, the quota was nearly 29,000 tons. The fleet caught less than half of it last year before the fish were too far gone. This is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
Interior Alaska farmers are losing money, but there's hope for the industry. That's the conclusion of a nationally recognized agricultural researcher who recently completed a study of Fairbanks area farming. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Ken Meter is president of Crossroads Resources Center, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that works nationwide fostering the local food movement. Meter says his analysis of Fairbanks Delta Junction area agricultural data identifies some startling results.
Farmers have basically lost $1 million each year, spending $1 million more producing their crops than they get from the market by selling them. In that time, farmers are also shipping about $5 million away from the Fairbanks area, buying farm inputs that can't be sourced here, buying machinery that's not produced by local factories, buying chemicals that are not produced by local firms, increasingly buying seed that's produced or owned by somebody outside. So a big flow of money away as farmers farm at a loss.
Meter says residents of the Fairbanks region spend about $250 million annually on food imported from outside the area.
And so if you total those three losses together, $1 million of farm production and $5 million of our input costs and $250 million worth of food, that's about $255 million leaving Fairbanks each year. And that turns out to be about 28 times the value of all the farm products produced by all the farmers in the region. So it's a really huge imbalance.
Meter says the outflow of income and dependence on distant sources puts the region at risk. He attributes the problem to global agribusiness that limits prices paid to farmers, but says there are signs of positive change in the Fairbanks area as people see the health and sustainability values of locally produced food.
Direct sales between farmers and consumers in the Fairbanks region are 8% of what farmers sell, which sounds like a small amount of money, but it's actually 20 times the national average. So what you have is this very flourishing industry of small farms who are connecting with local customers, selling foods at the farmers market through CSAs and so on, and those are more rewarding than a lot of the commodity exchanges, but they don't show up in the data because they're such a small percentage of the overall picture.
Meter says the local farmer-to-consumer sector needs to grow, along with changes to commodity-based agriculture, like getting interior-grown grains to local buyers rather than export. He cites production of Delta-area barley into flour for local use as a positive step.
The more we find footholds outside of that big system, the more we can build that kind of sense of social connection that allows us to really have a sustainable local economy.
Meter recently spoke at a sustainable agriculture conference in Fairbanks, attended by many area farmers. Fairbanks Calypso Farm and Ecology Center Director Susan Wilsrud says the local food movement is about more than just growing and selling produce.
We're an educational farm, so what we're doing is introducing children and adults to where their food's coming from. So younger kids are coming up to the farm to learn how to milk the goat, learn how to see where their vegetables are coming from. And then we're also doing workshops for adults. And then we have a network of school gardens, which does the same thing. It's really raising awareness about food production here in Alaska.
Wilsrud says the goal is to narrow the gap between food production and consumers. She says that includes having your own garden, joining a CSA, or buying local food at a farmer's market, co-op, or restaurant.
Building our whole local economy, not just keeping the farmers healthy and, you know, growing food, but also the consumers, whether it be an individual or whether it be a business, keeping those food dollars here and having them not leave the state.
Wilsrud says shopping solely based on low price usually sacrifices knowledge of food quality. She says Calypso and other area farms rely on buyers who trust their produce and are willing to pay a price that supports its production. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
How to successfully live off the grid in remote areas is the subject of a new book called The Alaska Homesteader's Handbook, Independent Living on the Last Frontier. The book features profiles and how-to tips by Alaska homesteaders and offers practical advice on a wide range of topics, from how to age game meat to packing horses for the backcountry to safely crossing rivers. The book's authors, Tricia Brown and Nancy Gates, divided 44 homesteader interviews. Nancy said it was a bit intimidating to go to their homes and ask personal questions, but she says once she did, it was so interesting she couldn't take notes.
Because I was so riveted by their expressions and by how they looked off in the distance and how they looked at their wives and smiled at certain, you know, I started taking a tape recorder so I could get all of the words and still be able to watch their faces.
Building root cellars, feeding your family, and how to handle isolation are also covered, along with many other useful wilderness survival tips. Tricia Brown says they wanted to cover the entire state because challenges vary by region.
I talked with the Helmrichs family that lives at Colville River up on the Arctic coast, and you know, they're second generation there. Actually, they have kids and grandkids there. Their difficulties are going to vary greatly from Steve Axelson, who's in a boat in Southeast, you know. So that whole aspect of it was extremely fun because we understand the breadth of Alaska and how it has all these microclimates and ways of living, but our readers outside don't always.
Nancy Gates says the book won't give you everything you need to live off the grid, but it does help you consider what those needs are and how to cope with things that will happen. She says the last homesteader in all of America is living here. His name is Kenneth Deerdorf.
He told us how to live in a tent in the winter. And he told me about how, you know, he didn't sleep on a cot because having cold air underneath you, it was hard to stay warm enough. So he would build up snow. He would shovel the snow away from where the wood stove was going to go inside the tent. And he would pile that where he was going to sleep. And then he would put like caribou skins over that and then his bedding on top of that. And he'd always arrange it so he could reach the wood stove so he could put in kindling and get the fire going before he had to get out.
The women say there is a difference between the latest survival movement called preppers and Alaskan homesteaders who were practical preppers. Not preparing for the end of anything, but with an eye toward living in the moment, being in Alaska, and being self-reliant. They also found that most homesteaders learned a lot from local Native people about how to survive. Tricia Brown says Dick Prenicke's book, One Man's Wilderness, attracted many people to Alaska in the 70s, and one of the people they profiled, Roy Corral, has a copy.
He had Dick Prenicke's book in his cabin in the Brooks Range. And then while he was away trying to make money so he could live without money, a bear broke into his cabin and ate the book. He said there was some of Dick Prenicke's words here and some of Dick Prenicke's words there. So, yeah, One Man's Wilderness got spread around a little bit.
The Alaska Homesteader's Handbook is available now. You can find links to it at our website, alaskapublic.org. This time of year, March Madness thrusts basketball into the spotlight across the U.S. But in Southeast Alaska, fans are focused a little closer to home. As part of our ongoing series looking at culture in Alaska, we visited the Juneau Lions Club 67th Annual Gold Medal Tournament. Teams from Sitka, Metlakatla, Juneau, Hoonah, Wrangell, Angoon, Klukwan, Yakutat, Cake, Haines, and Heidelberg competed against each other. And as contributor Scott Burton found, they play as much for the community as for the game.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, and the Juneau Douglas High School gymnasium is full. In Division C, roughly ages 32 through 42, 7-year defending champ Cake is playing Heidelberg. Tournament co-chair and player Edward Koch from Klukwan says it's for more than just the basketball.
They come back every year so they could meet their friends from other communities because it's so hard for people to travel around in Southeast. Some of them come and barter with each other for Native foods. We have a lot of people that are out in the common selling their beadwork. They reminisce about old times, the old timers do, and the younger ones watch and say, I'm going to be like them when I get older.
Koch guesses that 95% of the players are Alaska Native. It's all about the economics.
Since it's a fundraiser, the communities with the biggest crowds are the ones that get invited because we need the crowd to come in, and that's how we get our money to give to other people.
And when a team from a village plays, much of the village comes with them.
A long time ago in the villages, there really wasn't a lot to do, but they had A&B and A&S camps, so they built big halls, and they used the halls as gymnasiums. And that's where people gathered to burn some energy, and they just got to be real competitive in basketball, and they used to take seine boats from village to village so they can compete.
One of the guys who used to take a seine boat to play is Hall of Famer William Bean. He's on the top bleacher of the Cake cheering section. He's watching his son, point guard Rudy Bean.
All the old timers say Rudy plays exactly like his dad, and I take that as a real good compliment because he'll run up 50 points if you let him.
William's wife, Lucille, is holding their grandson, Rudy's 2-year-old son, Isaiah, who is evidently already dribbling and shooting. William won his first championship in 1966 and watches the game intently. Cake's 7-year reigning championship status is being threatened by a highly competitive Heidelberg. The play is intense, but so is the sportsmanship. Many opposing players help each other off the floor and shake hands after fouls.
Interplay between the different towns and the competition, trying to outdo one another by playing the game of basketball is a lot of fun.
As a Hall of Famer, he's given a lot of himself to the game, but he says it's taught him too.
It got me to realize that as you live your life, just like the game of basketball, people are watching you. And so when we play, I tell my boy, you know, you're playing in front of people, it's showtime. You gotta conduct yourself like it in such a manner as you're entertaining the people. So train hard, be a good athlete, and the people will enjoy watching you.
And that's become as much a part of the culture in Southeast as anything else. Despite some valiant efforts by Cake, Heidelberg wins comfortably. Unfortunately for Cake and Rudy, their reign comes to an end. Heidelberg's Hall of Fame center, Sid Edenshaw, gives credit to some young new speed on his team and humbly ignores his own part in the win.
Well, of course, it keeps me in good health, and that helps. But I made a lot of friends up in the northern communities, and just to come up here and get together and see friends from since 1983. I got a ton of friends here from all the villages.
Friends, good health, community, and competition. All to raise money for those in need. Sounds like a good game. For APRN, I'm Scott Burton in Juneau.
Heidelberg C lost to Hoona in Saturday night's championship game. Angoon won Division B, and Klukwan won the Masters Division. Our series on culture in Alaska is sponsored by the Alaska Humanities Forum. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Scott Burton in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Alaska Executive Search, providing temporary or full-time staffing for over 36 years, from executive and technical placement to medical in-office staffing. Alaska Executive Search, online at akexec.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.